Of all the lies told in public over the past 10 years, and there are almost too many to count, this may be the most painful of all. It's almost hard to watch, but we're going to play it anyway. Remember this?
Make your plan to get one of these vaccines. They are safe and effective.
If there's one message that needs to cut through all this, the vaccines are safe. I promise you, they are safe and effective. Listen to Dr. Fauci.
When we say that something is safe and effective, we mean it's safe and effective for everyone.
Our vaccinations against COVID-19 are safe. They are effective, and they're more important than ever.
This vaccine has gone through the necessary and rigorous evaluation that ensures the vaccine is safe and highly effective.
Of course, they were neither safe nor effective, and that was obvious right away, as people who took the vaccine continued to get COVID, and more ominously, as some of them began to die. And a lot of them, probably people around you, got sick in ways that no one anticipated. Anyone watching this carefully, and watching it at all, would know both of those things. And yet most physicians in this country lied about it, continued to lie about it, and to this day lie about it. That's the topic of another show. But today, we'd like to introduce you to someone who bravely told the truth, regardless of the cost, to himself personally, and that's Dr. Pierre Corey. He's the president and chief medical officer of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for coming on. And the point is really not to resurrect an incredibly painful moment in the country's history. It hurt even to watch that. Why are these people in jail? But to assess the cost now. So you hear, and one reason I'm so grateful you're here is because I think you're a responsible, science-based person who's practiced medicine for decades, and what you say can be trusted. Do we have any real sense of what the cost, the physical cost, to the country and world has been of those vaccines?
I do think we have some understanding of the cost. I mean, you're aware of the work of Ed Dowd, who's put together a team and looked analytically at a lot of the epidemiologic data. I mean, we have estimates for how many people have been killed. We have estimates now, pretty precise estimates for how many people have landed on the disability rolls. And all of those deaths and entries onto disability are timed with the onset of the vaccination rollout. And, you know, all these discussions about alternative explanations for why that might be, they all fail because you cannot argue against the temporal association. I mean, time with that vaccination rollout is when all of the numbers started going sideways. The excess mortality started to skyrocket. The disability claims started to skyrocket. So it's an immense cost, Tucker. I mean, we can be precise, but
on the conservative side, yep. You know, trying to be as responsible and fact-based as possible, but like, in this country, what kind of death toll are we looking at?
So just the most kind of alarming data that I've been writing about is just in 2023 alone, in the first 9 months, we had what's called an excess mortality of 158,000 Americans. Now, that's compared to baseline death rates in this country to before the pandemic. But this is in 2023. I mean, we've had Omicron now for 2 years, which is a mild variant. Not that many go to the hospital. When you look at what's driving those 158,000 deaths, and by the way, that's more than all wars since Vietnam, including Vietnam. That's more people dying than we've lost in wars.
In 9 months.
In 9 months of 2023.
Vietnam took 11 years.
Exactly, in 9 months. Now, all of that 158,000 is not all from, vaccines. There's a portion that is from COVID. Obviously, we have other societal ills which are troubling us. We have a drug epidemic. We have deaths of despair. But those are actually pretty well accounted for. And
well, those have been going on for some
exactly.
time.
You can't blame all that. Like, fentanyl did not just arrive in this country in the third quarter of 2021. And even more troubling with the data is, who is dying? It's not the elderly. I mean, our life expectancy in this country dropped by 3 years in a span of 3 years. Now, who has to die arithmetically for that to happen? Young people. And what the data is screaming is that it's not only the young people that are dying, but they're the healthiest and most employed. So the employed is a risk factor for death now. And so you're left with a conclusion looking at this data. You're left with two big questions. Why was there an explosion in the youngest, dying in the youngest and healthiest sectors of society? And why did the employed fare far worse than those that weren't? And it's particularly white collar. White collar more than gray collar, more than blue collar. And so you're left with the question.
Wait, fared worse?
fared worse.
That's the opposite of what you would expect.
100%. So why is the healthiest, most educated, wealthiest sectors of our labor force dying at higher rates than those that are what we call gray collar, like cops and teachers, versus blue collar? And you have to ask yourself, what happened in the American world? White collar workplace.
That's crazy.
Never. This is unprecedented.
Because that's the healthiest segment of society. People who are dragging their
always have been
themselves out of bed every morning.
Always have been. For very good reason. They tend to be the most educated,
yes,
employed, you know, wealthy, and so generally the healthiest. They have all the risk factors.
Fittest, best food.
100%. Exercise. And that's what my practice is full of today, is formerly really successful, healthy people who are now effectively disabled.
Well, that's even worse than I understood.
Oh, it's been hard to watch.
And when you made reference to people joining disability roles, what do those numbers look like?
So in 3 years, we've added, I think at the last count, 4 million people to the disability rolls. And again, another signal. Who entered the disability rolls? The employed entered at higher rates than the unemployed. And so why are most healthiest employed folks dying at higher rates?
Because you think, I mean, not to be rude, but I mean, I think social scientists have thought this for a long time. Disability is kind of stealth welfare for a lot of people.
Can be.
It can be.
Sure.
But if your people are leaving like decent jobs, that's the medical condition.
That's a good point you're making. Point. Why would someone leave a job to go on disability? I mean, disability is not compared to being employed.
No,
it certainly doesn't offer you the same.
No. It's like a seasonal thing.
Yeah.
You're a carpenter in a cold climate. Wintertime, you go on disability.
No.
But that's not this.
No, that's not this. And the most telling is really the data from the group life insurance industry, because group life insurance is generally, you're talking about Fortune 500 companies, right? So those of us who work for employers that offer us group life health insurance tend to be large corporations, that have the kind of resources that they can support their labor force that way. And when you look at the group life insurance industry, that was the kind of the canary in the coal mine, is when we started to see the reports in the life insurance industry, where you saw in the third quarter of 2021, just immense, a doubling of the death rates in the age groups of 25 to 34 and 35 to 44. And in one quarter, you just saw this explosion in dying. And no one's asking the question, Tucker.
I mean, okay, so it's... You've been practicing medicine for decades. You practiced for a long time in an academic setting at a big, big research university. So presumably you're familiar with these kind of data sets. Has anything like this happened that you're aware of before?
Unprecedented. And that comes from CEOs of the life insurance industry, right? So one of the big events was at the end of 2021, the CEO of One America, one of the largest life insurance companies, at a Chamber of Commerce meeting in Indianapolis, said that they were observing an increase in life insurance claims of 40%. Now, let's put that in context. He also said a rise of 10% year to year. Remember, this is life insurance industry. Right? How do they make their money?
Oh, yeah.
Predicting death rates very accurately, setting premiums appropriately so that there's a profit. If they see a 10% unexpected rise in a certain sector of society, that is a 1 in 200-year event. And here he says that they're seeing 40%. Unprecedented outside of wartime, outside of some major terrorist event, what could be causing such an explosion in dying of healthy employed people? And this is the secret that we know. This is almost like private knowledge, because we can't bring this private knowledge out into common knowledge. There's very few vehicles to do that. I think you've given the opportunity for many of us who have this private, really disturbing knowledge. But it's a challenge.
Well, it's just so crazy to me. I can't believe this is happening. And by the way, I have no weird agenda. I don't want it to happen. I think it's awful, actually.
Well, I think if I, you know, looking at the montage you showed before we started to talk, you know, that refrain of safe and effective, it's my kind of belief looking back and now, is that was a predetermined conclusion. There was no data to support that.
Yes.
But it was agreed upon that it would be presented as safe and effective. And for those of us who were a little bit more skeptical, more data-driven, we saw that it was based on really no data, and the data started going sideways south. But the refrain got louder and more pervasive, and then they doubled down. They started to demonize the unvaccinated.
Well, that's a criminal act you're describing. So, I mean, I could ask you so many different questions about why the people who made that claim and abetted the killing of all these Americans aren't being held to criminal liability for that. But neither of us is a lawyer. What was the effect on your life when you started to describe the data you were seeing?
Yeah, so I'm going to say that before I sort of dug deep on the data, I was seeing things clinically that was really troubling me. The amount of
clinically,
people,
so
clinical, meaning just observationally in my practice, people approaching
as a doctor treating
me.
Patients.
Yeah, this isn't data. This isn't, you know, numbers on
right,
paper.
Right.
This is just my reality started to send me that something was going on.
That same thing happened to me.
Yeah. It's not a question. And to other colleagues that I know that were observant, like
what did you see?
So people started to come to me complaining of lots of different problems after the vaccine. And, you know, I was advocating for a lot of things, fighting censorship propaganda. There's lots of lies that were told in COVID. I mean, the vaccine's one set of lies.
Yes.
The suppression of early treatment drugs is another. And they were kind of mirror images of each other. They both had the same goals. Slightly different tactics, but propaganda and censorship were the main weapons. So I've been kind of fighting one war and then got very interested in the vaccines because I saw a huge need. I started to meet lots of vaccine injuries, started to work with some of those nonprofits. You know, my nonprofit, which is we're a medical education organization focused solely on developing treatment protocols for all phases of COVID, prevention, treatment,
yes,
long vax, long COVID. But then we started to get really interested in vaccine injury because it was a new disease, it was a new problem. And also I want to tell you another deception. The entire country medical system calls the chronic problems after COVID, they call it long COVID, right? You've heard of the term,
yes,
disease long COVID. So I'm an expert at it. But the reality is, if you look at my practice, maybe 1,200 patients, 70% are long vax, not long COVID, meaning all of their issues, the syndromes started after the vaccine, not COVID, the vast majority of long vax. And so the only disease that's recognized in this country is long COVID. All the academic medical centers, they have these little long COVID clinics. It's not vaccine injury clinics, it's long COVID clinics. So there's this constant burying of the role of the vaccine in what's befallen society.
But why? I mean, that's so evil that it's hard to believe it's happening.
It threatens so much. It not only threatens the reputation, credibility of our health agencies, which is already, I think, splintered and fragmented.
Yes,
I mean,
forever.
A week ago, a paper was published in Journal of American Medical Association. I just saw it this morning, where they actually surveyed people's attitudes towards the agencies and the vaccines. And a majority, about half to 60%, all have concerns over whether these things are safe. Now, I don't think that was going to be the answer 2 years ago, but a good portion of society now is now questioning not only whether the agencies are telling the truth when they make these proclamations, but you can see it in their hesitancy to get the boosters. I mean, those numbers are plummeting. So I do think that people are slowly becoming aware. But for those of us who've been aware for a long time and have been trying to fight to get people informed, it's been a war. It's been a long couple of years, and all of us have suffered from censorship, loss of jobs. I've lost 3 jobs in COVID from my advocacy and expertise, and so it hasn't been easy. But
you lost jobs in science.
Well, yeah, I lost clinical jobs. My first one, I have to admit, I resigned, but for really serious reasons. I saw what I thought was unethical behavior that was early in COVID. The second one is because I gave public testimony in the Senate around the use of ivermectin. And then the third one, it's pretty clear that came from outside. They told that hospital to get rid of me.
Because they just had too many competent doctors. They didn't need another?
Something like that, Tucker.
Did you ever think that could happen here?
Never. Never. I mean, if you look at my partners, right? So my organization, where we call ourselves the FLCCC, founded by Professor Paul Marek, who's the most published practicing intensivist in the history of our specialty. He was railroaded out of his hospital with a sheaf of complaints about his behavior after 30 years as a physician, as a celebrated physician who's won awards, lectured all over the world. Suddenly he has 8 complaints and they get rid of his privileges. My other colleague, Umberto Maduri, one of the world experts on the use of corticosteroids, he works for the VA, which is the federal government. And he gets pressure to resign. They told him they would take his pension if he didn't resign. And he was also privately told that information came from Washington. And I've seen this in some of my other colleagues. Jim Thorpe, one of the most outspoken OB-GYNs in the country, he lost his job, even being the most productive physician in that group. We know that the pressure's coming from outside. They need us to lose our jobs so that we lose credibility, so that we lose our voice, because nobody wants to listen to someone who is uncredible. they do this to Bobby Kennedy all the time to try to censor him, right? Because if they can't get you to shut up, they just take away your reputation.
But if the evidence presented you suggested strongly that the compound you're suggesting or requiring is killing people, you would think your own conscience would restrain you. I can't push this shit. People are dying. Like, doesn't anyone think that?
I don't want to make excuses for people's behavior, but I will be generous and say I think many of them trafficked in a toxic medical intervention. I think many can claim ignorance because I think most physicians are victims of the lies propagated in the high-impact journals. That is a whole issue. What's happened to the high-impact medical journals over the last several decades, how they've been completely captured and run by the pharmaceutical industry, means that the pharmaceutical industry can get doctors to believe whatever they want.
And they publishing in a small number of journals.
Absolutely. I usually say the big five, you know, it's New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association, yeah. The Lancet, the BMJ, and Annals of Internal Medicine. But there's a few others. But when you get a paper in there, I mean, that's like, you know, planting a stake in the ground of truth, right? And so if you get a paper, a review paper saying that something's safe and effective, those doctors are now responsible to inform you because this is the heights of science. This is the best journals done by the best. This is the impression they have. And I got to tell you, Tucker, this is what I believed before COVID. I literally idolized, deified those journals. I really thought the best science and scientists were published there. And through this journey—
In the world,
by far. And to get a paper in there, I thought it would have to be, you know, airtight, best study design, the most meticulous data keeping and analysis. And what I've discovered is that's not true and hasn't been true for a long time. And former editors of those journals are on record. They've written books. As long as 20 years ago, the former editor of New England Journal of Medicine, a woman named Dr. Marcia Angel, she wrote that over half of what's published in those journals, you should not be believed. And she was a 20-year editor of the top journal in the world. Or former editors of the BMJ have tried to say that these warnings have been put out, but they're suppressed. We don't have a class in medical school, by the way, of pharmaceutical industry influence in medicine. I think that should be a required curriculum for anyone going into medicine. But we are purposely kept in the dark as to how controlled and how much financial interests are involved in everything. The guidelines we read, the studies that are done, the studies that are not done, right? So there's things that they don't want to study because they don't afford profits to the system. And so it's gotten really dark for me. The way I look at science and medicine now is extremely different than
it's freaking me out. I'll tell you that. So how aware of any of this were you before 2020?
Well, I got to be really humble. It's almost funny. I think my understanding of pharmaceutical industry corruption was like at the level of the drug rep, you know, the very pretty or handsome drug rep who comes in with the high heels and the nice smile and gives pens and invites you to dinner. Like, I thought it was that kind of corruption was like most of what they did. Now that's like the icing on the cake. They literally bake the cake. And they can get doctors, going back to your original question, they can get doctors to believe whatever they want to get doctors to believe. And doctors still have an implicit faith and trust in the institutions of science, including which is the agency. So agency heads, when they make a proclamation on national television, that's considered to be scientific truth. Something published in a high-impact medical journal is scientific truth. So they believe these institutions without knowing that they've been captured.
Thanks for watching that amazing conversation with Dr. Pierre Corey. Now, if you're a certain age and you believe in the dignity of the individual, you probably think government is the greatest threat to your freedom and your well-being, and it may be. But government doesn't act alone. It acts in tandem in this country, and this is a new thing, with corporate America. It's corporate America that's making America ugly. It's corporate America that's building dollar stores in your neighborhood. It's corporate America that employs the HR morons who scold you and try to dehumanize you. You hate to think we've gotten to a place where corporate America is as great a threat to you as, say, the federal government under Joe Biden, but it is. So what do you do about it? Well, we recently discovered a marketplace that is doing its very best to change that. It's called Public Square, and it's established a new way of conducting commerce by connecting you with over 80,000 small businesses that may share your values. It feels good to put your money where your values are. Learn more at publicsquare.com. Why do you think all these people are dying?
From the vaccine?
Yeah.
Now we're going to get science-y.
Why do they? I mean, so, you know, I understand everything you're saying, and I'm trying to be compassionate, and I've been misled many times in my life. And so people can be misled, of course.
Yeah.
But if you have a massive rise in life insurance claims and group policies, like even I understand that is, wait, slow down, what's going on? How do they account for that?
They don't know about that. They don't know about that. I mean, I would say things have changed in the last few months. So since August, myself and my writing partner, Mary Beth Pfeiffer, really terrific investigative journalist who first wrote a book looking into chronic Lyme disease. She's done great work throughout COVID. And she and I have now written three op-eds in USA Today, Newsweek, and then a couple of weeks ago, The Hill. And each op-ed is a little bit more, it's calling attention to all of the excess death. Like, why is our government, our public health agencies not doing anything about this? I mean, they literally have one job, which is to protect public health.
Yes.
And they're sitting on an unprecedented surge in dying of Americans, the youngest and healthiest of Americans. And they seem to not be questioning that. And so we are trying to call attention to that. And I would say the last one that got published in The Hill, that seemed to create a little bit of a news cycle. You know, I was on Fox with Laura Ingraham. I think she was interested in learning more about this. And we've seen that, you know, there's a little bit of social media traction, but there's no official governmental recognition. Now they've put out papers showing that they're aware of the mortality, but no follow-up. Or they'll give a list of reasons, right? Like the list of reasons, well, they don't always get as ridiculous as global warming, but they get close. Just trying to explain away this sudden surge in death. And it can't be done.
So what is the CDC, for example, or the federal government more broadly doing for the vaccine injured?
Very, very little. I'll give you an example. So remember, there is no such thing as vaccine injury syndrome, although I specialize and I have a whole practice which focuses on it. It's all long COVID. So let's just pretend that they're studying vaccine injury with long COVID. $1.2 billion has been dedicated to funding long COVID research. This is as of 2 months ago. Only four trials were set up to enroll patients. Only one trial was ready to enroll patients. And that was a trial studying Paxlovid. Paxlovid. If anyone could ever tell me one rational reason why that would work in long COVID, I'm all ears. There's no justifiable rationale for why you would study Paxlovid. Now, why you would want to study Paxlovid, that I can easily answer. It's a very profitable drug for a certain pharmaceutical company. But literally, we're 3 years into the pandemic. We don't have like a really good response into studying and treating long COVID. Instead, it's me and a whole network of colleagues and my organization that are really sharing experiences, insights into pathophysiology. We're doing reviews of like a lot of basic science studies showing us what the mechanisms of injury are from the spike protein, from the virus, from the vaccine. And we're trying to marshal mechanistic therapies. But like, it's like we're out here in the Wild West doing it on our own. And it's really a shame because it doesn't have to be this way.
This is not what you signed up for when you became a physician.
No. I mean, I was a system physician. I was embedded in that system. Like I told you, I was I believed in the journals. I taught what I was taught. I believed all vaccines were safe. I never questioned vaccines. I mean.
So why do you think, and I think you speak for the overwhelming majority of Americans, when you think our basics, you know, we've got flaky politicians or weird seasons, but the systems, the institutions that make this not third world are totally sound. I think everyone thought that. I thought that. But what about you allowed you to see what was happening and be honest about it? Why not everyone else?
Well, I've always questioned orthodoxy, especially in medicine. Like from early on when I was a doctor, when I would come in, and especially after I got some training, and I would come into a new ICU or a new hospital, and I'd see like how they were treating, for instance, like kidney injury. And I'd be like, that's weird. That's like data from 15 years ago, like, why aren't we doing it this way? We now know this, this, and this. And that could apply to almost any, you know, heart failure, heart attacks. I knew there was evidence showing more insight and more effective therapies, but yeah, we were doing stuff in the past. And I just think change in medicine comes very slowly. And I was always an early adopter. I like to study new novel therapies. And so I was actually, you know, I talked about Paul Marek. I was celebrated in my specialty, pretty well known nationally and even internationally because I was a pioneer in a field called critical care ultrasonography. And a textbook that I was the senior editor of is like one of the best-selling textbooks in that field around the world. It's 7 languages. And so I taught for years around the country doctors this new skill on how to use ultrasound to make life-saving diagnoses, like critically ill, you know, patients crashing, you put a probe on their chest, you could see what their heart was doing, the right ventricle, left ventricle, the lungs were full of fluid. So it was this huge, like, it changed my life when I learned ultrasound. I felt like I was a super doctor, like a doctor with superpowers. And I tried to teach those powers, and it became standard of care. Now there's not an ICU in the country that doesn't have an ultrasound machine in it. Most critical care doctors now get trained. There's certification exams that you can do. And that's what I did for most of my career. And I got interested in something called therapeutic hypothermia, which is how to treat patients after cardiac arrest with brain injury. And so I'll just finish by saying when COVID came, you know, I was like, game on. I mean, I was 50 years old. I'm a pulmonary critical care physician. I saw pulmonary and critical care disease literally enveloping the world. And I think innately just committed to learning everything I could to figure out how to treat it. And I had some giants around me. I had Paul Marek around me. I had Umberto Maduri around me, Joe Frone, you know, and Jose Iglesias. That's kind of the 5 ICU docs that started our organization. And all we did was read papers and the emails, like preprint servers and the papers that we're reading. And then we were fashioning protocols and we were learning stuff that worked and what didn't. And just, it was this frenetic push. And it's something that they should have done that at the government level, had like a group of committed frontline clinicians have a seat at the table. No clinician has ever been given a seat at the table. No real frontline.
By clinician, you mean a doctor who treats patients?
Yes. Yeah, that's what I mean by clinician. Yeah. Someone who is literally immersed in patient care. Now, you have people in those 3-letter agencies who, yes, they'll see patients on the side most of the time in specialty offices. They weren't deluged seeing like these acutely ill COVID patients to the hundreds, if not thousands. And I was seeing them not only at the most severe stages of the game in the ICU, but also as an outpatient. And so I had a wealth of experience and insight into the disease and how to treat it. No one ever asked us. And whenever I would try to bring out my insights, it seemed to get attacked. So
what did you think of for a while, my impression is that the putting people in respirators was part of the protocol.
Well, yeah, you know, that's true. It's a little bit of it's definitely more nuanced than that. But I would say this, the push to put someone on a ventilator, they probably did it too early as a rule early on. I think a few things drove that. It was ignorance of the disease, yep, the trajectory of the disease. I think there's a little bit of fear around controlling infections. So that definitely, I think ventilators were overused. But that wasn't, in my opinion, the main problem. The main problem was that we were not treating. We were literally saying supportive care only. This is the first year where, you know, fluids for hydration, nutrition, oxygen, Tylenol for fever. That's what's called supportive care.
There's I could do that in my house.
Yeah, you could. but, you know, that seemed to be our response. And like Paul says, you know, my partner, he says, you know, there is no disease you cannot treat. And there's really simple stuff that we knew that would help fortify immune systems and help protect against severe disease that we thought that are super safe, that on a risk benefit precautionary principle, we should have as a rule just recommended vitamin D for one. We should add a vitamin D, supplementation campaign nationwide. Would have been very easy to do. Now, as an aside, vitamin D has been one of the most attacked substances over the last 3 or 4 decades by the pharmaceutical industry.
Why?
It threatens the disease model. I mean, we can do an hour on vitamin D, Tucker, but
Vitamin D like in milk?
Yes, like vitamin D. Like vitamin D is a whole other discussion, but they're terrified of vitamin D. Our normal reference.
Can I say, if you find yourself terrified of vitamins, you're probably on the wrong side.
Exactly. You're probably on the wrong side. And yeah. There you go. I think you got it. But yeah, no, it's you know, I wrote a book called The War on Ivermectin, and the genesis of that book, not only is it my expertise on ivermectin and my vast clinical experience, but I tell this story before, but I got an email during this journey from a guy named William B. Grant. He's a professor out in California. And he wrote to me this email just one day. My life was going totally sideways because our protocols focused on ivermectin. I was using it a lot in my practice, as were tens of thousands of doctors around the world, to really good benefits. And I was getting attacked. There was hit jobs in the media. And he wrote me this email, and then he said, "Dear Dr. Corey, what they're doing to ivermectin, they've been doing to vitamin D for decades, and included a link to an article called The Disinformation Playbook. And it's got five tactics. And these are the five tactics that all industries employ when science emerges that's inconvenient to their interests. So I'm just going to give you an example. Ivermectin science was extremely inconvenient to the interests of the pharmaceutical industrial complex. I mean, it threatened the vaccine campaign. It threatened vaccine hesitancy, which was public enemy number one. We know that, that everything, all the propaganda and censorship was literally going after something called vaccine hesitancy.
Yes.
They were trying to extinguish
it. I experienced vaccine hesitancy myself.
It's a terrible condition. Or life-saving
one. I'm grateful for it.
It could be a life-saving condition. But they deployed this information, and I didn't understand what was going on, Tucker, because when I, for instance, I gave testimony in a Senate hearing for the first time in May of 2020, had nothing to do with ivermectin. I just said that it was critically important that corticosteroids be used in the hospital phase of the disease. I was attacked widely for saying that, even by my own university. They did not want me talking to the press. And that was based on the expert opinion of my group. Umberto Maduri was one of them, like I said, one of the world experts in lung injury and corticosteroids, myself and Paul. And we were validated there because 2 months later, a trial came out of Oxford showing that huge mortality reductions when you use corticosteroids. And now it's the standard of care worldwide. 6 months later, I go back. Now I'm an expert at an early treatment drug, which is ivermectin, do the same testimony. It goes viral on a Fox News website, which was the most watched, got up to 9 million views, and then it was taken down in the middle of the night. And this is before the fraudulent trials, which showed that it supposedly didn't work. So they had no data to show that it didn't work. All the data showed that it worked. Now, they changed that equation using disinformation. But the point is, I couldn't figure out, like, I gave that testimony. The Associated Press did a hit job on me within 2 days. They sent the reporter. I buried her with all this data, all these trials, all these health ministries, you know, in South America and other places that were literally obliterating COVID. And she wrote an article about how it's another drug to be debunked, like hydroxychloroquine. And then she even wrote about some couple who drank like a fish cleaner or something like that. This was in an article interviewing me about ivermectin. It turned into this. We actually filed an ethics complaint. This is how naive I was at the time. This is almost 2 years ago, over 2 years ago. We filed an ethics complaint with the Associated Press. We were so disturbed by this article. We didn't know that the fix was in. But the point of that story is, when he sent me the article, the link to that article, I read it, and it was like my mind exploded. I suddenly saw the world differently, because every tactic that they described, I had dozen examples of in relation to ivermectin and even hydroxychloroquine. And so I saw that myself and our organization were literally like the Bad News Bears fighting like a war, a global disinformation campaign trying to destroy early effective treatment drugs in order to prop up this vaccine campaign.
Craziness.
That's my life.
So, but I mean, what you're really saying is that the drug companies applied pressure to the medical establishment to withhold life-saving treatment so that people would have no option but the vaccine.
Differently, I think all of it starts at the level of the medical journals. Because once you have something established in the medical journals as a, let's say, a proven fact or a generally accepted consensus comes out of the journals. So that, I think that's the core of the corruption. And what I, in fact, in my book, I document very well, in particular, just using the example of ivermectin, does not have to be about ivermectin, but I mean, I have dozens of rejection letters from investigators around the world who did good trials on ivermectin, tried to publish it. No, thank you. No, thank you. No, thank you. And then the ones that do get in all purportedly prove that ivermectin didn't work. So, and then when you look at the ones that actually got in, and this is where like probably my biggest estrangement and why I don't recognize science and don't trust it anymore, is the trials that flew to publication in the top journals in the world were so brazenly manipulated and corrupted in the design and conduct. And many of us wrote about it, but they flew to publication. And then every time they were published, you saw these huge PR campaigns in the media, New York Times, Boston Globe, LA Times. Ivermectin doesn't work. Latest high quality, rigorous study says. I'm sitting here in my office watching these lies just ripple throughout the media sphere based on fraudulent studies published in the top journals. And that's that has changed. Now, that's why I say I'm estranged and I don't know what to trust anymore.
You speak for so many, but you speak from obviously a much deeper reservoir of knowledge when you say that, which makes it even more upsetting. I lived it. Is there hope for reform?
At the medical journal level, I don't know. I think that's a complex topic, although I don't want to get political here, but I did listen to an interview with Bobby Kennedy, and I heard this. I never forgot it because to me it spoke to my heart, but he said if he were to ever become president, one of his first orders of business would to call into the Oval Office the chief editors of all the top journals and tell them, clean up your act or I'm going after you with RICO statute as a racketeering organization, which is interesting because the name of the chapter, there's a chapter in my book called The Editorial Mafia. And so when I heard that Bobby Kennedy was going to bring these guys in the Oval Office and threaten them with RICO statute, I was like, oh, he knows what he's doing. He knows exactly what the problem is and what to do about
it.
So, but as far as reform, you know, going back to maybe this current issue that you kind of invited me to talk about, right, which is this just unprecedented excess mortality that we're observing, not only in this country, right? I don't know if you follow, but the UK, there's a couple of brave politicians there trying to bring this issue to the forefront. Australia, Canada, a lot of the advanced health economies of the world are seeing really large and unexplained excess mortalities, even as COVID has waned in severity. But in order to address this, I mean, first of all, this is the clearest indictment of our public health agencies, which is just their inaction. The knowledge that this is occurring and they're not doing anything tells you that they have failed. It is the most clear evidence that they have failed and are failing. If they were functioning, this would be a major public health initiative. There would be lots of funding. You'd have tons of studies looking at causes. And these studies are easy, by the way, because they could do one thing that no one has done in advanced health economies, which is give us open source, rigorous data of vaccination status and outcomes. We want to know who's unvaccinated, who's vaccinated, and how they're doing. And they try to avoid doing that. So that there are solutions to doing it, but I think you need people free of conflicts. I think we need like industry to get involved, not just the academics and the agency folks. But like, for instance, get someone whose conflicts of interest would promote study like this, like the insurance industry. They are looking into a shellacking. They are getting hammered. Look at how much they're paying out. And you can see it in some of the industry trade magazines. They literally have never paid out this much money. And keep in mind, you pay out a policy on a 32-year-old. How much money have you lost compared to when you pay one out on a 58-year-old? And so
for a 78-year-old.
And there is a collaborative of insurance guys that I've worked with. And by the way, I was on a call a year and a half ago. I was invited to present data to a group from a whole bunch of different life insurance companies. Almost all of them had their cameras off and almost none said anything. I would say about 30 people on the call, only two people actually had their cameras off and were asking detailed questions. But they showed up. And I found out from the guys who organized it that many of them were like under the CEO. It wasn't the CEO showing up, but, you know, they sent someone there to listen. And so they're well aware of this. And if you think about the insurance industry, right, how much they've done to protect the health of a country, again, in their interest, but like automobile safety with seatbelts,
right,
fire codes, electrical codes, nautical, building, right? All of those things, obviously it protects their business, but it also protects our health. And I would just like to see maybe someone who's interested in finding out the answer why everyone's dying. I mean, I think that industry wants to know that answer more than any other, and they have the resources to do it. But I think government and other medical experts need to help, and they need to be of a diverse spectrum and transparent.
Such a wise point. So I just want to end by hearing what you are seeing in your clinical practice now with the vaccine injured. And I think it's important that people hear it because everybody knows somebody. I know a couple of people, but it's sort of hard to know. Like, what are we looking at? What are you seeing?
So this is just kind of my perception of vaccine injury is that when I use the term vaccine injury, I'm usually referring to what I call a single organ problem, like pericarditis, myocarditis, stroke, something like that, an autoimmune disease. What I specialize in my practice is I treat patients with what we call long COVID, long vax. It's the same disease, just different triggers, right? One is triggered by COVID, the other one is triggered by the spike protein from the vaccine. much more common as long vax. The only real differences between the two conditions is that the vaccinated are on average sicker and more disabled than the long COVIDs, with some pretty prominent exceptions to that. But the point I want to kind of give you, Tucker, is that the disease, although it has a new name, long COVID, it's not a new disease. It's been around for decades, and it's traditionally been called myalgic encephalitis / chronic fatigue syndrome, which MECFS. You've heard of CFS?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
That's effectively what long COVID and long vax is, because the hallmarks of that disease is a new inexorable fatigue, what's called post-exertional malaise, which means when they try to do even simple activities,
yes,
they pay for it in terms of fatigue.
Yeah, they're enervated. Yes.
Yeah, they're like a classic example. I give one of my patients, like he'd go to his mailbox to get the mail from the curb, come back into his house, and he'd be in bed for 2 hours. Like that's classic post-exertional malaise. And then the third is what we call brain fog, which is some amount of cognitive limitation. But that triad, that is MECFS. And that's always been associated with infections, things like Epstein-Barr virus. But the difference now is the rate at which it occurs with coronavirus and this spike protein and this vaccine is so high that, like I said, just me and my partner alone manage over 1,200 patients. And they're mostly disabled.
And you're, because there was some debate about whether chronic fatigue syndrome had psychiatric origins or physical origins.
Yeah, I think that's always been a debate, and that's always been a problem for that disease.
Yes.
And that's why there's very little to show for it in terms of great studies. About the only thing they know about how to approach that disease is you tell patients to pace themselves, to stay under that exertional limit that makes them sicker. And pacing is a good part of what we do. But we've learned lots of different therapies. But what makes our kind of plight easier is that we're learning so much about the pathophysiology of the spike protein and what it does to the body and all of the disturbances that it causes, that because we know it's the spike causing it here, so I don't have to worry that it's some psychiatric illness or depression or something in the environment. Like, I know what it is. It's the spike protein. I'm learning a lot about the spike protein, what it does to the body. And then we choose medicines whose pharmacologic mechanism of action best counteract those disturbances in pathophysiology. And we have a lot of success, but I will tell you, nothing works in everybody. It's really a trial and error system. We use our most frequently effective medicines first, and then I have second, third, fourth, fifth line, and I have things where, like, I'm trialing new things. You have to do it. The patients are suffering immeasurably,
and so they're tired, out of
foggy, can't do very much. Many of them are housebound, so some start bedbound. Some are housebound. Some can go out for short excursions. But most of them are nowhere near living the life they used to live.
So what happens to their relationships?
You know, that's a good question. That's a cool question because I've thought about that myself. I've seen some decimated people. And by and large, I can't think of an example. Their partners have stayed with them. Their partners have supported them. I've seen a lot of love and devotion, at least in my patient population, that I kind of wonder when that's going to be, when some partner is going to say, you're not who I married, I'm not happy, and leave them in the illness, which is what you're not supposed to do in the marriage vows. But I haven't seen that very much. But clearly their relationships are affected. The partner also suffers. The partner can't go out to dinner with them. They can't go see a ball game. They can't go on the trips they used to go on. And so they're all leading different lives, but I've seen a lot of partner support and commitment.
I mean, if you knew that your life had been completely destroyed, you couldn't work, you couldn't even go out to dinner because you were forced to take a vaccine and no one ever apologized or, you know, stood up to help you, how angry would you be?
The amount of anger it's incalculable. The patients that I see, they are equal parts angry. I think wrongly they feel ashamed because they were duped. You know, they did something. Many of them were actually kind of reluctant. Those are the worst. They really didn't want to. They pushed back a little,
exactly.
Tried not
exactly.
to. And then finally succumbed because their livelihood was on the line. And then they got injured. And those are the ones who kicked them. So there's a lot of regret, shame, anger. And then some of them, there's also a lot of, you know, they're injured, they're sick, but they're active in vaccine injury groups. They try to share their experiences with things that have helped them. They advocate, they reach out to their politicians, trying to bring this more to common knowledge.
But they have no power. There's nothing they can do, right? They can't sue Pfizer.
Nope, not yet.
So I know someone, I have a close friend who was forced to take the vaccine and has been sick ever since, 2.5 years, all the time, COVID repeatedly, and all kinds of, every flu, I'm assuming
that's part of what can happen. My patients, it's not so much the immunosuppression, it's really that CFS component that I see, the chronic daily symptoms. So it's the triad that I talked about, which is fatigue, post-exertional malaise, brain fog. And then next on the list is neuropathies. So sensory neuropathies, just such high rates. So burning, tingling, pins and needles, and odd distributions, odd times a day, different severities. Many people are burning or numb or they feel pain.
What is that?
It's what's called a small fiber neuropathy. So it's the tiny nerve endings that infiltrate our skin, and they got inflamed or damaged. I think some of it's probably autoimmune. Some of it's probably from microcirculatory problems, something called microclotting. I don't want to get too sciencey if you don't want me to, Tucker, but it's small fiber neuropathy is very high rates. And then equally incident is something called dysautonomia or POTS, where resting heart rates are like 110, where like you have these fit people who are exercising, they enjoy their resting heart rate of a 60, right? When those of us who fit, when we have those, now they're sitting in a chair, there's 95, 100, they go walk to the bathroom, it's 140, or they get up suddenly, their blood pressure drops. And it's basically the small nerve fibers that control constriction of blood vessels and control our heart rates are all off. And so when you try to do some activity and your blood pressure is not appropriate for the activity, the heart rate's not appropriate for the activity, good luck doing that activity. And that's another thing that drives
that seems like a stroke risk.
If it's severe enough, it could be. But no, generally the stroke's not what causes that, but a lot of dysfunction, a lot of fatigue. And then a whole bunch of other stuff. I have skin manifestations, different GI things. Because the other thing, remember, a lot of our GI system is autonomic as well, right? Peristalsis, gastric emptying. Right. You don't think about that. That's all supposed to be under the control of the body. And now the small fibers aren't telling you to propel the food down your intestine or to empty the stomach. And so many of them have lots of food intolerances. It ramps up allergies. I see patients who could tolerate every food and everything. Then they, after the vaccine, suddenly complain of immense amount of allergies to things. I could go an hour with what I see. It's so broad, so vast. It's an immensely complex disease. I will say most of the time it's satisfying to treat because I would say the vast majority, if not all of our patients, get better to some extent. The problem is it's the minority that we get to get back to baseline, a distinct small minority. The vast majority, modest to large improvements. And then I have a cohort, which I really, even after a year now, I'm having difficulty helping appreciably.
I mean, at what point does this end?
Well, if you look back at papers on ME/CFS, they say that in their lifetime, only 5% ever get back to baseline. And so for most, with the chronic form that I see, it's accepting a new life and set level of functioning.
For people who are watching this and want to learn more about what you're doing and more information on this, feel like they might fall into these categories, where would they go?
So first is my organization, so flccc.net. We have protocols, so we have sort of recommendations of things that we find are helpful for treating vaccine injury, long COVID or long vax. We also have it on treatment of various other infectious illnesses. We even have a monograph on Reperfect drug for cancer that my partner just worked on over this past year. And so we have a lot of unbiased, unconflicted medical information that's come out of deep study or clinical experience. And I think that's a first step. And then obviously I have a private practice. I couldn't treat the country, but we certainly see patients in all 50 states and we do what we can. And that's drpierrecorey.com. But that's really what we focus on is these two diseases. It would take me 10 years. And even in 10 years, I don't think I'd have all the answers. But we're learning every day and we're getting better at what we do every day.
Dr. Pierrecorey, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tucker. Amazing.
So one man who was at the Capitol on January 6th, one of many thousands, saying he's being prosecuted by DOJ even though he didn't do anything. He was in the building for 1 minute. He left the second Capitol Police told him to. And we have the footage to prove that. But they've destroyed his life anyway. and almost nobody has told the world about it. That man joins us next to tell what is happening to him now. One of the things we learned, maybe the main thing we learned when we finally got access to thousands of hours of surveillance footage that the January 6th committee had been hiding, is that some of the people the media told you were terrorists, they were terrorists that needed to go to prison, and who did go to prison, actually never committed terrorism of any kind, just the opposite. They just kind of wandered through the Capitol building. That's true of Jacob Chansley, the so-called QAnon shaman, the one the media told you should be killed. But he's hardly the only one. This is video of a man called Daniel Goodwin walking through the Capitol through an open door on January 6, 2021 at exactly 3:32 p.m. That is long after the doors were breached. Now, we got this video, the one you're watching now, from the Speaker of the House's office earlier this month. Mr. Goodwin's attorney tells us that the legal team was also provided this video. And in it, you can clearly see that Goodwin was inside for less than a minute. And when he was asked to leave, he left. So there's no dispute about any of that. It's all on tape. But the DOJ is still trying to send Daniel Goodwin to prison. And in the meantime, they have completely wrecked his life. Daniel Goodwin joins us now, along with his lawyer, Carol Stewart. Thanks to both of you for coming on. First to you, Daniel. Your story, I think, is similar to the story of many people in your position. But just give us a sense of what the federal government has done to you for the crime of wandering around the Capitol for 1 minute and leaving when asked.
Thanks for having me on, Tucker. Yeah, it's what they've done is I had to spend about a month incarcerated pretrial and then about a year in pretrial home confinement. And I was facing 20 years and now I'm still facing 1 year.
You're facing a full year in prison for that.
That's right. I was in there for less than a minute.
And I just want to be as fair and transparent as possible. Is there anything you're leaving out? Did you commit vandalism? Did you hurt anyone?
It's actually in the documents that I even said I didn't steal anything. I didn't break anything. You know, I didn't hurt anyone, anything like that.
So, I mean, how is what they're doing to you allowed in this country? I mean, you seem like a political prisoner. What would be another name for it?
Political hostage, because prisoners have rights, and they've taken many of our rights away as January 6ers.
It's disgusting. Carol Stewart, you are representing Daniel. Thank you for that. How common is this story? I strongly sense that Daniel is not alone in having his life destroyed by the Biden administration for not really doing anything.
Yes. Good evening, Tucker. Thanks for having me on. Also, I just want to point out Joe McBride is working on this case, too, and has been helping.
Yes, you know him.
And you know him. So this is very common. The majority of people, and I've read through many cases, have done nothing violent. They've broken nothing. They were there where they believed they had a right to be. No signs, nothing indicated they could not be there. And they are being labeled as domestic terrorists.
So this is such an atrocity that I think a lot of people watching, and I just want to say in good faith, we are holding nothing back. We don't know anything that we're not telling you if you're watching this at home. This is the sum total of the story, as far as we know. How can people help? What, the media is not covering this. No one in Congress seems to care, with a few exceptions, Marjorie Taylor Greene being one of them, but most don't care. So how can people who do care make a difference for these, and I'm just going to say it, these political prisoners, because that's what they are?
Well, the first thing, of course, is if Kevin McCarthy would release all the footage to all the public. The thing that the public can do to help is they can research through the footage that's already out there. They can go to stophate.com/J6 and see our calls to actions, which include praying for us, which include fundraisers to the people. You can make sure the money goes to the people themselves, and which includes writing letters to the people who are currently incarcerated. You can also watch documentaries that have been made and the truth, which is going on out there, which is being held back by the gatekeeping media that, for example, four people died that day and they were all Trump supporters. Of course, you've revealed that Sicknick died the next day and it wasn't because of Trump supporters. There was a lot of police violence that happened that day. And that needs to be investigated.
January 6th, I think, is probably second only to the 2020 election, is the biggest scam in my lifetime. And you know it is because they become completely hysterical when confronted with any facts that deviate from their lies. So I am grateful, Daniel Goodwin, that you came on tonight, Carol Stewart, who's representing him, and Godspeed. Thank you.
Thank you. God bless you.
So just in case you think we're being hysterical or overstating the case, this assault on civil liberties, on the most basic human rights of all, Joe Biden is now trying to throw a man in prison for years for mocking Hillary Clinton voters on Twitter 7 years ago. That case is about to go to trial. More on it next. The federal criminal trial of a man called Douglas Mackey began this week in Brooklyn. It's the single greatest assault on free speech and human rights in this country's modern history. The Biden administration is trying to send a man to prison for saying things they don't like and create a precedent so they can do it to you, too. Here's the background. During the 2016 presidential campaign, Mackey posted memes that made fun of Hillary Clinton and her supporters. One of them on Twitter read this way, quote, "Avoid the line. Vote from home. Text Hillary to 59925. That was obviously a joke, and everyone knew it was a joke. But the FBI, which probably has nothing else to do, tracked down several people who texted that number in Mackey's meme. None of them remembered even doing it. And that's according to discovery in the case. So there's no victim here. No one was fooled by what Mackey did. And yet, days after Biden took office, 4 years after Mackey posted that meme, the feds arrested him, and they charged him with conspiring to interfere with the rights of American citizens. He'd go to jail for 10 years for that. That means if you crack a joke on the internet that Democrats don't like, federal prosecutors get to decide you're interfering with an election. It's hard to imagine a more Soviet prosecution than this, but it gets worse. The DOJ's key witness against Mackey is a member of Mackey's group chat from 7 years ago. But DOJ will not let his lawyers, Mackey's lawyers, conduct a full cross-examination from that witness because he works for the FBI. In other words, the FBI put an agent in his group text. DOJ just obtained an order, quote, precluding questioning by the defense concerning the details of any of the confidential witnesses' current proactive work for the FBI or any other government agencies. What? The DOJ is also telling Mackey's lawyers they can't even say the name of this witness, this snitch, in open court. Now, that violates the confrontation clause in the Constitution. You get to confront witnesses against you in a free country, especially when they're FBI informants. But that no longer exists. The DOJ says if this man's identity is disclosed, he will face online harassment. Therefore, he gets to testify anonymously. What's incredible about the standard is it does not apply to the defense's own witnesses because rights only apply to the Biden people. Yesterday, a hatchet man with the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization that currently employs at least one suspected domestic terrorist who was recently arrested, reached out to a defense expert witness called George Hawley. The Southern Poverty Law Center's goon also obtained Hawley's private emails and questioned him about them. He threatened to write an article about Hawley and asked Hawley if his employer was aware that he was a witness in this case. That's witness intimidation. That's what it is, witness intimidation. And it worked. Hawley had to withdraw as a witness. He's not an FBI informant, so he gets no protection from harassment. Today, Judge Nicholas Garofis postponed the trial until next week so defense can find a new expert. He should dismiss this case immediately with prejudice. Everything about it, starting with the charges themselves, so the timing, to the intimidation of witnesses, violates the Constitution. And if free speech, the First Amendment, means anything, it means that what's happening to Doug Mackey is an outrage and should end immediately. We'll be right back.